So the talk that I'm going to give, which I'm working on, it's not finished. And so I have my pen here, and I'm kind of editing it. It's called Inspiration-Obsession, as if the two may be antithetical or they may be very closely aligned. Inspiration is an elusive term. We all want to be inspired if the consequences are something original and worthwhile. We'd even be consent to be haunted or obsessed if the consequence was significant. What does it mean to be captivated by an image, a phrase, a mood, an emotion? This is a wonderful little quotation paragraph from Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations, which I once used as an epigraph for a novel. I find it a very, very interesting comment. A picture held us captive, and we could not get outside it, for it lay in our language, and language seemed to repeat it to us inexorably. In other words, something holds us captive. Could be a picture, could be our view of the world, and we're trapped inside it because our language keeps us there. We have no way to get outside that captivity. We could not get outside it, for it lay in our language, and language seemed to repeat it to us inexorably. Most serious and productive artists are haunted by their material. This is the galvanizing force of their creativity and motivation. It's not and can't be a fully conscious or a volitional haunting. It's something that happens to us as if from without. In the book of short stories I talked about in Brad Morrow's class, which is called Sourland, the obsessive note that runs through the entire book is just the desperate terms that one will survive on. That is, if you're so desperate, the terms of survival are such that to another person might seem tragic or just completely unacceptable or even unbelievable, but to the person for whom that's salvation and survival, that's life itself. So Sourland takes its title from the Sourland Nature Preserve, which is actually in New Jersey, where I've gone hiking, which is a place of very outsized rocks. We didn't talk about this in the class, but the rocks are very exposed and very bold, large boulders, and it's kind of like a primitive landscape. And so when you go into that, maybe many of you are hikers, this is a part of the world where people do hike, you sort of go into that world and you have your boots on and you hope that the rock won't be wet and it won't slip and break your leg or something, and you're kind of going into another landscape. You're in your human world and you have your gear and your hiking, your stick and so forth, but you're going into the world that's primitive and primeval. So Sourland is actually the name of that place. In my book, though, I said it in Minnesota. I didn't want to put it in New Jersey. Somehow that seemed too small. Minnesota is just far enough away. But New Jersey, you know, think, well, Tony Soprano land. Then I have a little section, I mean, it's really very short, about Emily Dickinson. Most of her poems we revere and have lodged deeply into us are beautifully articulated and delicately calibrated cries from the heart and formulations of unspeakable things. And we didn't talk about this in Brad's class, but I think a lot of art is about the unspeakable, that you try to evoke it, you can't speak about it. And music is maybe always about that, beautiful music. And extremes of literary art, like Shakespeare's tragic plays, are about unspeakable situations, but the poet gives beautiful poetry to it. And Emily Dickinson is always writing about things like that, at the point at which the poetic inspiration has become terror-filled. And this is a wonderful poem of hers that's in five stanzas. And probably a lot of you know this poem. The first day's night had come, and grateful that a thing so terrible had been endured, I told my soul to sing. She said her strings were snapped, her bow to atoms blown, and so to mend her gave me work until another morn. And then a day as huge as yesterday's in pairs unrolled its horror in my eyes until it in my face until it blocked my eyes. My brain begun to laugh, I mumbled like a fool. And though 'tis years ago that day, my brain keeps giggling still. And something's odd within that person that I was, and this one do not feel the same. Could this madness be? That's basically about many times Emily Dickinson writes about that edge where you're really fearful that you're going over into madness. And she writes about it in beautiful metaphors, but they're very sometimes painful to read. I think the image in that poem, this image of something almost unbearable coming, I think of it like a giant scissor. She talks about yesterdays and pears running over. Now here's a more benign sense of fate, because inspiration is usually, or much of the time it's positive, with ambiguous consequences. And some of you know this story, but it's actually a wonderful story. H.M. had been a highly successful young writer with his first two novels, quickly written in his early 20s, following his seafaring adventures in the South Seas. Taipi, A Peep at Polynesian Life, 1846, and Omu, A Narrative of Adventures in the South Seas, 1847. So there are two books back to back, and they're both bestsellers. They were just straightforward, tall tale kind of seafaring stories about a young man. Now he's working on a third seafaring novel narrated in a similar voice, this time set on a New England whaling ship called the Pequod. Herman Melville, as a young man, had sailed with a New Bedford whaler into the South Pacific, where after 18 months he jumped ship in a South Seas port. Going to sea for Melville was the beginning of my life. He's writing fluently on his new novel. You have to imagine he's only a little more than 30 years old. He's a young man. He has two successful best-selling books. He really was very, very popular. He's sitting up writing in longhand on a new novel, which is going to be about a whale named Moby Dick, and he's working on it. When a book of short stories came into the house, Mosses from an Old Manse by Nathaniel Hawthorne, which had been published a few years before. Now, Melville, at 31, younger than Hawthorne by 15 years, had heard of Hawthorne and was well aware of him the way we're all well aware of distinguished people, but he hadn't read him until now. So he read the book very quickly and was astonished and mesmerized by it. Quote, "It is that blackness in Hawthorne that so fixes and fascinates me." Melville took time off from writing his novel to write a monumental essay, of course he didn't know it was going to be monumental, but it's become famous, on Hawthorne and his mosses, a famous essay in which he speculates, quote, "This great power of blackness in Hawthorne derives its force from its appeals to that Calvinistic sense of innate depravity and original sin from whose visitations no deeply thinking mind is always and wholly free." Hawthorne's influence upon Melville was immediate and profound. Both personally, Melville seems to have literally fallen in love with the handsome, distinguished Hawthorne, feeling that was not reciprocated. Hawthorne did come to admire Melville, and he liked him, but he didn't have the passion that Melville had. It's just too vehement and passionate. But this influence is just extraordinary. What would have been another seafaring adventure tale, another bestseller, was transformed by the enchanted Melville into the intricately plotted, highly symbolic, and poetic Moby Dick, the greatest 19th century American novel, and very likely the greatest American novel of all time. Some people might argue that it isn't exactly a novel, it's sort of a genre busting work of fiction. It's fantastic work. Melville was consumed by Hawthorne's prose style as well as Hawthorne's tragic vision, which he aligned with Shakespeare. And if you read Moby Dick recently, you know that it's very suffused with Shakespeare as well as Hawthorne. The scenes where Ahab comes on deck and the scenes are described like drama. Ahab on deck, you know, and he has this monologue, which is very Shakespearean. The result is a novel like none other that had ever been written, an idiosyncratic, savagely brilliant, and original work of fiction that to many readers at the time, including educated reviewers, was virtually unreadable. So Melville wrote a work of surpassing genius for which there was virtually no audience. Just nobody there. Out of this purely accidental inspiration by an older contemporary, Melville was driven to write Moby Dick, a great novel, we think of it today, a crushing failure to the young author at the time. And basically the response to Moby Dick destroyed Melville, though he had a long decline, and he kept on writing for a long time, but he was devastated. He thought he had written a great novel, and he had written a great novel. Now, you probably won't even believe this, but all the reviews were negative. The good news is you've written the best novel that's ever been written in America. The bad news is that all the reviews are completely negative. His early novels, the lightweight novels, did very well and got great reviews and sold very well. And here he's written a great novel, and it was all negative. One newspaper headline in New England had a headline, this is the headline, Herman Melville Crazy. So you can imagine your own name and then crazy. This is your book review. Yeah. There's nobody in the audience, including me. I have this dark vision. I could never imagine anything more horrible. So Melville continued to write, and he wrote in this kind of obsessive way, and he continued to write in that new visionary Shakespearean, Hawthornean mode, but he never regained his old optimism or his success. Quote, dollars damn me, he said very famously, because he hadn't enough of them. Now, by the time he died in 1891, all of his books were out of print. His name was forgotten. Henry Melville was the name in the New York Times obituary. So when I know this story quite well, and I've always thought, what would you want? Would you want to write Moby Dick and have something for posterity that is truly a great novel? It's a fantastically wonderful and very idiosyncratic novel that anyone who's read it never forgets it. Or would you want to have had happiness and reasonable success in your own lifetime? I don't have this in my little talk, but Melville and Hawthorne visited back and forth a bit. As I said, Melville was very passionate. It may be, as some people think, that there was a homoerotic element in Melville's great love for Hawthorne. But I don't know if that's true, because the love began with reading the prose rather than, then he met the person who was quite handsome and dignified. But the Melville family, maybe Melville's wife reported how Hawthorne would come to visit, and they would go in Melville's study, and they'd drink, they had something to drink, the door was closed, and they would talk all night long. Like, what were they talking about? And Melville's wife and her mother, I think, they would kind of go and put their ears by the door, but they couldn't really make out what these men were saying. Now, I always thought I'd like to write a story about what they were saying, but I think I'll give it to somebody in the audience here. Or I'll give it to Brad when Brad finishes his novel. But isn't that amazing to think that these two great men who, at the time, you know, they were... Hawthorne was well known, but who would have known that they'd be so great and so famous, and particularly Melville, that they're together all night long drinking and talking, but what were they talking about? Then after that, Hawthorne never was friendly with Melville again. He just kind of stiffly drifted away from him, and Melville died a very sad and lonely death. Anyway, to me, that's a very interesting story. Inspiration, in the sense, a double-edged sword. What should we make of it? In the short run, what seems unmistakably like failure, but in the long run, great success. Now, another example, the writer is extremely, extremely successful, particularly posthumously. Many of these people have posthumous fame. I know that most of you want fame right now and for your lifetime, and also posthumous fame, you know, the whole thing. But some people, you know, have to content themselves with posthumous fame. The challenge was to write a ghost story. So Lord Byron had suggested to his friends traveling in Italy in the summer of 1816. And so a few nights later, Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin Shelley, 18 at the time, she was 18. Mary Shelley was 18 years old, so that's like a college freshman. She recounts this nightmare that she had. There's a lot of pressure on them. She was the only woman writer in this little group. Shelley and Byron and some other, they were all men. And she wanted to be a writer, and so she was on tremendous inferiority sense with these, particularly Byron was so famous. Quote, this is her dream. I saw the pale student of unhallowed arts kneeling beside the thing he had put together. I saw the hideous phantasm of a man stretched out and then, on the working of some machine, show signs of life. His success would terrify the artist. He would rush away, hoping that the thing would subside back into dead matter. He sleeps, but he's awakened. He opens his eyes. Behold, the horrid thing stands at his bedside, opening his curtains. That's an amazing dream to have. It's sort of a miniature, the whole story of the novel, Frankenstein. Now, when you read Mary Shelley's response, there doesn't seem to be any sense here that the allegorical horror story is written or imagined by the author herself. She's the passive observer. The vision seems to come from a source, not herself. She just falls asleep. Byron has suggested a ghost story. She falls asleep and she has this dream. Yet it can have been an accident that Frankenstein, telling of a monstrous birth, was written by a young, unmarried, pregnant woman who had had two babies with her mercurial and unpredictable poet lover, Percy Shelley, one of whom had died. So imagine yourself 18 years old. You run off with this man, Shelley, who's married to another person, actually, and he left this other young woman behind. These are actually girls, like 16 years old. You've had one baby that died and another baby, and you're pregnant again, and you're with this person you can't really believe is going to stay with you very long, but you adore him, and then you had this fantastic dream. Following the dream, Mary Shelley had her subject. She spoke of being possessed by it. First, she thought that Frankenstein would be just a short story. But then, as time went on, it became a curious, heavily Miltonic, allegorical novel. Many of you read Frankenstein, and you know it's not an easy read. It's not sensational. It's actually a little dull. I mean, it's a Miltonic, dogmatic, didactic novel. Finally, it was finished, rejected by both Shelley's and Byron's publishers, of course. And they're not going to publish this girl's novel. But then it was finally published on an anonymously in 1818. So you could finally get it published if your name wasn't on it. She was 21 when it was finally published. Now, since then, Frankenstein has not been out of print and might be considered the most extraordinary novel ever written by an 18-year-old woman in thrall to a brilliant but wholly unreliable romantic poet. And what a wonderful irony that Frankenstein is known all around the world and read and all these different film versions. People who have never even heard of Percy Shelley and have never heard of Lord Byron. She's completely outshone them. Unfortunately, they had never heard of Mary Shelley either, because nobody knows that Frankenstein was written by Mary Shelley. I mean, most people just think Frankenstein was some mythic creature, like a fairy tale creature. Today, Frankenstein isn't identified as the doctor creator of the monster, but the monster himself. And Mary Shelley's horrific creation has been detached from her, prevailing in our culture as an iconic figure that seems self-generated. I'm going to skip a little here. I have a little section leading into my story about teaching at San Quentin, but I'm just going to move on for a second. Here is a smaller and unambiguously benign inspiration, the genesis of a remarkable short story by Catherine Mansfield called Sun and Moon, written when Mansfield was 30 years old. I don't know if any of you know this story. It's very short. The story is lyric and fluid. It's a beautiful, beautiful story. like ice melting, an astonishment to have come virtually complete out of a dream. I would compare this story, Sun and Moon, to a watercolor that was executed like in 5 minutes. In her journal for February 10th, 1918, Mansfield wrote, quote, "I dreamed a short story last night, even down to its name, which was Sun and Moon. It was very light. I dreamed it all about children. I got up at 6:30 and wrote a note or two because I knew it would fade. I didn't dream that I'd read it. No, I was in it, part of it, and played around me invisibly. But the hero is not more than 5 years old. In my dream, I saw a supper table with the eyes of five. It was awfully queer, especially a plate of half-melted ice cream." This story, for all its delicate filigree, is a heartrending prophecy of the destruction of childhood innocence. The plate of half-melted ice cream is a little ice cream house that is melted away amid the debris of an adult's party. I give this story to my students at Princeton. I teach writing workshops, and tell them to see if they can get inspired by their dreams like that. This is the most, I think, most astonishing example of the dream inspiration. A curious sort of inspiration, which is like Catherine Mansfield's Yet Stranger, is Joseph Heller's account of the genesis of his famous novel, Catch-22. Some of you probably know about this because there's been a new biography of Heller that just came out about a month ago. Out of nowhere, Heller claimed, of course, he had been in World War II. He had been a bomber pilot. This has to be explained. He had a whole life. But anyway, he wanted to be a writer, and suddenly, out of nowhere, the opening line came to him. It was love at first sight. That's going to be the first line of something. The first time X saw the chaplain, he fell madly in love with him. So those first two sentences came to Heller out of nowhere. And he didn't know that the name would be Yossarian. I think it's Yossarian. And he just put an X there. It was love at first sight. The first time X saw the chaplain, he fell madly in love with him. Just came to Heller for no reason. Could be explained. Yet within 90 minutes, as Heller claimed, he worked out the entire novel in his mind. Its unique tone, its tricky form, its admixture of black humor and horror, many of the distinctive characters. The genesis for Heller's subsequent novel was equally mysterious. The inexplicable sentence, "In the office in which I work, there are four people of whom I am afraid. Each of these four people is afraid of five people." The title of that story is Something Happened, and some people think it's his best novel. His daughter, who took a very jaundiced view of his writing career because sometimes she mentioned her in a very negative way, she said, "Something definitely happened, and it wasn't so good." So this is, he was riding on a bus in New York City, and this line came to him, "In the office in which I work, four people, which I'm afraid, and each of these four people is afraid of five people." The bizarre beginning of a novel that would absorb him for many years. Again, he claims to have known within an hour the beginning, middle, and ending of the novel and its dominant tone, anxiety. Now, I take that the most strange kind of inspiration. I've never had anything like that. I think poets have that. Poets get lines that kind of, sometimes a poet will have a line that's just rhythm, and some of the words are not even there, you know. And a poet can work with the musicality. I've had dreams that give me a title and dreams that give me characters who are kind of phosphorescent and shimmering, but not very real. But no way that I found it easy to inscribe it. In fact, it's even harder to work with something from a dream because it seems so very perverse. More usually, inspiration is highly personal. James Joyce is captivated by the city of Dublin, Ireland, and in a succession of brilliantly imagined fictions, short and long, accessible and extravagantly obscured, he commemorated the city as it existed in the early years of the 20th century more vividly than any photographs or documentaries. Now, some of you have read James Joyce, you know how he loved the physical world. He loves the sensuous world. He loves to describe fabrics and people and flesh and trees and clouds and smells and rain. And he loved to describe music and musical voices. He had the whole lilting Irish accent, the Irish speech that you can hear in Joyce's writing. He was somebody who really loved life, and he wanted to replicate it. I was saying in the class today, it's maybe not known generally that James Joyce never wrote anything violent. He abhorred violence. He was not at all a violent person. And there's almost nothing in any of his writing. There's no violence at all. There are some references or memories of something maybe happening. But when you think of Ireland with its troubles and the history that Ireland had with the British, the oppressing British, it's amazing they have an Irish writer who just abhorred violence as a theme. But even more interesting to me, Joyce said about Ulysses, a favorite novel of many writers, for all its complexity and the Odyssean grid beneath, it was, quote, a means of capturing the speech of my father and my father's friends. I thought that was really beautiful. He wanted, as a little boy, he heard his father, I think, sang. I think he had a beautiful voice, and many Irish men sang, and they played piano, and they were all drinking, and at the pub, and they're singing, you know. If you spend any time in Ireland, you know, it has always been a pub society. People sit and drink, but they're not just drinking to get drunk. They drink and recite poetry today, even. They drink and sing. I was in Galway not too long ago, and then the Irish poets were, and they were pretty drunk. They drank so much that it's actually unbelievable. But I'm really quite astonished. They start like 5 p.m., and they just drink, and they drink, and drink. And they're reciting beautiful poetry, their own poetry, and Yeats, and beautiful voices. And then one sang some poems of some songs of Bob Dylan's, which he considered great poetry. It was really magical, and we would not have that experience in this country, I don't think. People might drink, but then they just go to get drunk. So what happens was, we left at about 11 p.m. We were quite ready to go to bed, and we were in a hotel, and evidently they continued drinking and singing and all this all night long till the pub closed. Then they went to somebody's room, and they continued drinking and drinking. And then at 7 a.m., they were dancing the hornpipe. I mean, I can't believe this. And one of them, I won't say who it was, who's American-Irish, an American writer who lives in this country, he fell down at 7 in the morning dancing the hornpipe, having drunk all night long, and his skull was sort of concussed. He was actually in the Galway hospital for about a month. You know, it has sort of a horrific ending. But I thought, what a different world. And James Joyce was a tremendous drinker. We would probably say he was an alcoholic, but the alcohol maybe liberated him. Maybe he was some repressed person, he was liberated. And he wrote this brilliant novel, quote, to capture the speech of my father and my father's friends. Then my last example of inspiration is the Surrealists. The early Surrealists considered the world a vast, quote, forest of signs, to be interpreted by the individual artist. Beneath its apparent disorder, the visual world contains messages and symbols. Like a dream, is the world like a collective dream? The Surrealist photographer Man Ray wandered the Parisian streets with his camera, anticipating nothing but leaving himself open to chance, like whatever he would see. The most striking Surrealist images were, at the start, seemingly ordinary, but made strange by being decontextualized. Quote, beautiful is the chance encounter of a sewing machine and an umbrella on a dissection table. There is something thrilling about the Surrealist adventure, moving out into the world to discover what awaits us, a found image, a found poem. So I covered these various kinds of inspiration, from the one that seems very faded, like Emily Dickinson, and then very kind of double-edged Melville with Hawthorne, sort of like a fatal love affair he had that changed his life. And then with Mary Shelley being so inspired by somebody telling her to write a ghost story, but then it's kind of connected with her own physical condition and her anxiety, that she created a great work that endured. And then the examples of Joseph Heller, I think, is so weird, and Catherine Mansfield, another dream inspiration, and then James Joyce being inspired by the real world. He walked all around. Many of you probably know that Joyce was a young writer. He had his notebook. He wrote around. He walked around. He had this epiphanies. He wrote down things. He'd overhear people talking, and he'd look at things and describe things with beautiful language. And all these things wound their way into his writing and became part of his first book, which is Dubliners. And then I end with the Surrealists, who are kind of wonderful examples where they go out in the world with a camera, just kind of go out in the world. You can walk around the streets of New York City taking pictures and seeing things. So the inspiration is completely from the outside. So that ends the first part of my little talk. Then I had mentioned before that I volunteered to teach at San Quentin in the spring of this year. My husband and I, my new husband, I married not too long ago. I remarried, and he's a neuroscientist. We went out to Berkeley where he was teaching, and we thought we'd volunteer and teach at San Quentin. Now, the interesting thing about San Quentin, I will not talk at great length about it because I could obviously take up so much time, but San Quentin is all, it's all men. I have to say that naively I thought that I could maybe work with women. Then I actually got there and I was told, oh no, the women are way far away, like 2-hour drive at some dismal facility, whereas San Quentin is right across from San Francisco, and it's a very beautiful, from the outside, the facade of San Quentin is very beautiful. You can look it up on, and you can Google it and see how beautiful it is. It's not to say that it's beautiful inside or that it's beautiful all through, but that sort of signature building is very beautiful. And San Quentin's considered, quote, like the Harvard of California prisons. Men who are in these different prisons, first of all, it's a terrible life to be a prisoner, and the prisons are all overcrowded. There's a gymnasium where there are just hundreds of men together, and they have to group themselves according to skin color and race or identity, because that's a kind of tribal way that they survive. There's no idea of integration, and liberal ideas of integrating the races and so forth, forget it. As soon as you enter the prison world, you're in a primitive culture where your skin color is your identity, and if you don't like that, there's nothing you can do about it. If you're white, you can't join the blacks. And in the California prisons, the great tension isn't between black and white, but between northern and southern Hispanic. Those two are at war with one another for control of drugs. It's a sort of a gang situation. Now, the desperation of the average prisoner in San Quentin carries over a little bit into the educational program, but not entirely, because the students we had were in a college, like taking college courses for credit. And we had people who were lifers mostly. They had like 20 years to life, 30 years to life. They mostly committed murders when they were probably fairly young. But they were eligible for parole. If you're in for 20 years to life, that doesn't mean you're going to be in for life. You could be in for life if you keep doing things that are violent in the prison. But most of the people we had were looking for parole. They're looking for, and I had one student who was 62 years old. He was going to be paroled in May, and he was walking with a cane. You know, it's just very, very astonishing. And younger people, a kind of array. Now, the reason I'm going on about this at some length is my story is called San Quentin. It just came out in Playboy. There's a new issue of Playboy. And it seemed to be really incongruous that this story, which doesn't have anything sexy in it, and no women or nothing, no Playboy bunnies. It's a pretty serious story, but it's very short, would come out in Playboy. But the reason I'm mentioning this is what struck me about my teaching at San Quentin in contrast to my teaching at Princeton, and I would assume if I were to teach at Bard, that it wasn't so much that the ages are very different, a sharp contrast, obviously, between the experiences. But no, it was really what I would call imaginative flexibility. That was the difference. Princeton undergraduates, or say Bard undergraduates, want to learn and to improve. They assume that they will be criticized in some way, it's hoped constructively, by their instructor. But the San Quentin students reacted to the most mildly suggested criticism with a kind of startled stiffness and wariness, as if you were attacking them. The idea in prison is that each man has like an aura of dignity or self-respect. You can't cross that line. You can't disrespect this person. If somebody's sitting at breakfast and you walk along and bump his head like this, he could just turn around and kill you because it's an act of such transgression. We don't have a sense of that in the world out here. But I felt that my students, my writing students, had worked so hard to write anything that when they presented it to the class, that was it. Whereas the writing students at Princeton or students at Bard, you really want to learn, like you're presenting it to your instructor and other students because you want some feedback. And I thought it was kind of interesting, that imaginative flexibility that students will have compared to the inmates who felt that this was a disrespectful thing. And it wasn't quite hostility that they expressed, but kind of a startled look, like really looking at me as if I had reached over and slapped her face or something. So I soon learned to really keep back and to be very careful. So you can't really teach people much in a situation like that. You can encourage them to keep on working, but you can't teach them. So I thought that was very interesting. The very act of writing for them was audacious and breathtaking. And most of them are enthralled and captivated. They're inspired, that's not the right word, but they're obsessed with their own crimes. They're obsessed with the reasons that they're in prison. Some of them have been in prison for a long time. And I wonder what to make of such hauntedness. One of the prisoners who addressed a group of visitors to San Quentin in the prison chapel, he spoke of his crime, which led to a life sentence at the age of 17. That's life sentence, but with possibility of parole. He had joined a gang. He had a shotgun. He brought the shotgun home. He was in his room, probably preening and looking in the mirror. He was in this gang. And somebody entered the room kind of behind him. He turned and with a shotgun and blasted this person, who turned out to be his younger sister. He killed her, and he killed himself. That was like the end of his life. So he's much older now. He's about 40 years old, and hoping that he'll be paroled, and who knows, maybe he will be. But I thought that was just extremely interesting that the students of writing are flexible and want to learn. And I remember as this person told a story, I had the sense that the story was like a fairy tale. It was the story of his life. And he told it over and over again to groups of people who were brought through San Quentin in a tour. He is telling it ever since it happened. If he were to write about it, how would he write about it? Could he write about it? The material is volatile and beyond comprehension. It simply is. Telling the story in this way repeatedly, like a character in a Beckett play, is probably the nearest a prisoner can come to transcending it, but one feels that would never happen. When an experience is traumatic, it's very difficult to render it into another form as art, for this is inspiration as obsession or fate. Well, I see I've actually run out of time. I'm so sorry. I think I just should move to the questions and answers. Anyway, I do have this little story called San Quentin, and it's not that I want you to rush out and buy Playboy. but the funny thing about the Playboy issue is that it's only 60 cents. It's their anniversary of when the first issue, which is only 60 cents. And the story that I wrote, which I just don't have time, I'm so sorry, I don't have time to read it, and it's too long for me to not, to read it. I can't really read it that fast. It's about one of my students, but completely transmogrified, somebody who is really inarticulate. And I give him a voice in the story so that he's speaking. And it's not that I think definitely that this is his voice, but I felt that it was a voice that expressed someone who had said in something he wrote, the writing is somewhat faltering and it's not assured at all. He was fascinated with the idea of how you kill a person. How does a person die? And what does that mean, to kill and to die? He just kept thinking about that. What does that mean to kill somebody? He said he'd been thinking about that like for years and years and years. Does a person die because he has been killed? Or does a person die because it's time for him to die? Do people give up and then they die? Or does some force make them die? And it became like this very inarticulate, rather short man. He was speaking in a stuttering and stammering way, almost like a philosopher. It was almost like metaphysics. And what he was dealing with, I thought, was profound. And there was no way that he would be able, I guess, to explain it or to deal with it, because he was sort of stuck. It's like he was stuck on this riddle. Anyway, these are inspirations, and obviously I was inspired by going to San Quentin and by teaching. And I was saying in the class, in Brad Murrow's class this afternoon, that what is so wonderful about life and storytelling is that if you might travel somewhere, you might just go to some city, you might be all alone, you might be hiking, you might just call your old friend from high school, and a story is set in motion. There's a narrative that begins, and it's real, and it may have a fantastically unpredictable ending. Sometimes it's just an ordinary ending, sometimes very positive. That is how people meet, how they fall in love, how things happen between people, and then 50 years later, they're celebrating their anniversary and their children are there. It's just sort of the story of life and how these narratives that we write about are actually out there in the world. So thank you. That's the formal part of my presentation. Thank you.